Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to bring a well-known literary character to life without disappointing the millions of readers who fell in love with her on the page? The challenges were many for the producers of The Number One Ladies Detective Agency, a new HBO series based on Alexander McCall Smith's wildly popular series of novels. Here we hear Ma Ramotswe explaining her plans to sell her inheritance of 180 head of cattle and set up her dream career as Botswana's first and only female private eye.
And can I ask why a fine woman like yourself wants to become a detective?
Because I love my country, Botswana, and I love Africa, and I want to do good with the time God has given me. In every bottle store, in every bar and market, behind every window, there are so many people who want to know the truth about some mystery in their lives, some mystery they cannot solve themselves. That is what a detective is for, and that is what I will do.
That was a clip from The Number One Ladies Detective Agency. The sold-out screening, sponsored by the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture, takes place tonight, but you can catch it as a two-hour movie premiere on HBO March 29th, followed by a series of one-hour programs. Producer Amy J. Moore is here to talk about the extraordinary people who made this all happen and the extraordinary challenges that they faced. Amy, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Chris.
You discovered this book really before it became a runaway sensation. Can you talk about your first response to it? And you had been to Botswana.
Well, I actually had hitchhiked around Botswana 20 years ago. So just when I was right out of college and knew the country very well, but knew the country actually from the perspective of when the books were written. So the country is very different now, actually. But these were self-published by Alexander McCall Smith, who we call Sandy as a nickname. And I had been given one. I was running the first Black Empowerment Film Company in South Africa. So I was actually handed the book and sat down one very cold August morning and just read the entire thing. And when I came to, I often talk about this, when I came to a passage on page 225, I was just hooked. And his description on that page was just so riveting that I decided I had to make this movie.
What was the description about?
Well, it's actually from J.L.B. Matacone's point of view, and he talks about what Ma Ramotswe means to him. And in doing so, he really describes what Africa meant to me. And it has to do with motherhood, the sky, the sweet breath of cattle, the tears that giraffe, you know, that sort of fall into the baskets that the women weave. It was just magnificent. And I just, from that point on, I decided that was 9 years ago, about. I mean, it was August, you know, 9 years ago. And it's been an amazing journey.
Did Sandy Smith see this instantly as a potential film, or was he hesitant when you approached him?
Well, he's this magnificently generous, brilliant man who has both a medical degree and a law degree. And he used to write as a hobby, and he would do tiny self sort of published imprints of short stories that he would give to people for Christmas. And this, he had written one book in this series, The Number One Ladies Detective Agency. And he had plans for Tears of the Giraffe, but he basically just, you know, he was thrilled. He actually called me. He had known of my work in Africa, and another cold Saturday afternoon, actually in August, I got this booming call with this voice that said, "Amy, it's Alexander McCall Smith," and I just, you know, that was very memorable to me as well.
And what did it take for you to convince other people who had the money and the resources to get this done? Because this is a movie without major Hollywood stars. It's a movie with no white characters whatsoever.
Right.
It really doesn't fit the profile of what we see most of the time.
No, you know, it was one of those things. I had met earlier in the year when I was headed down to South Africa to take over as CEO of New Africa Media Films. I had met Anthony Minghella in London on the street corner. And I was hanging out with my friend Joan Chen, who you might all remember from Bertolucci's The Last Emperor and Twin Peaks and Shosho, The Girl Sent Down. And she knew Anthony. And so she was just finishing some music by Gabriel Yared, who does our music in the number one ladies detective agency. And she was really scared of him because he had this sort of big manner with her. And of course, she was the director of this very celebrated film with Richard Gere. And, you know, and she asked me, she was staying with me in London, and she said, "I'm scared of him. Will you come and help me through this, you know, this music mix? So we were standing on the street corner outside of Abbey Road Studios, and Anthony came along and just invited us basically to come to his house for tea. And I was headed down to Africa, and he said to me, and Anthony was really just the most sort of mouth-watering man when it came to sort of saying, "I will do this," or "I will," you know. And he said, "I will," you know, Joan said, she's going to Africa, she's starting a film company. And Anthony said, "I will come down and shoot something there for you." And I looked at him and I said, "How's Tuesday?" You know, I didn't have the book. I hadn't really settled into the job. But I believed him. And it was really sort of a foolish thing to do. But I just, from that point on, I was just convinced that Anthony Minghella was going to shoot a movie for me.
And there's a funny story about you actually convincing him to do it in Botswana, which is something that was very important to you from the beginning.
Because
most people typically, they'll work in South Africa where there's an established industry.
Yes. South Africa has all the crews, it has the equipment. And he couldn't understand why I was so dogged about Botswana. Of course, I had a very, very long relationship with Botswana. And I said to him, I said, "Look, Anthony, we've got to do this in Botswana." And even Botswana, I don't think at that point really understood what we were doing. And Anthony looked at me and he said, "But Amy, there are no restaurants in Botswana. There are no restaurants.
There's no Spagos."
So it was a challenge. I mean, but forget the restaurants. There was no film equipment. There was no film stock. There were, you know, no gaffers. And we made, from the outset, I actually went and spoke before Parliament and to convince the Botswanan government that they needed to do this. And it was really, and they sort of started getting on board. And once they got on board, then Harvey Weinstein got on board. And it sort of snowballed. And now, of course, I mean, right before his death, Anthony used to go around and talk about how he had always wanted to shoot in Botswana.
You were that convincing that he looked back and thought, I've always wanted to do this.
But you know, you're a producer, Chris. You know that whenever, you know, a female succeeds in this business, all the males take credit for it.
Well, that's why we have you here talking about this. What role did the government want to play? Because I know they kicked in some cash, but they also had some requirements and they wanted their own people to benefit from this.
They did. But it was funny because we, you know, they were very, very new at this sort of stuff. And they didn't, you know, we kept trying to guide them. We kept trying to set benchmarks for them. And the Botswana, which is the plural of Motswana, and it describes the people of Botswana, as Joel would say, basically are very smart, very well educated. Most of them have been outside of the country. That it's a very, very good population, but they had no understanding of a film industry. So we would say to them things like, you know, you will want us to employ people from Botswana. You will want us to, you know, spend money in the country that you bring forth. So we tried to do a bunch of that sort of educational process with them. And we're very excited because now they're starting their own film office. And so the legacy of this actually is moving on and is taking on some permanence, which is last year when we started shooting the series, we had 2,335 people working from the country for us. And
this is a country of only, what, like 1.7 million people?
1.7 million people, yeah. So it's so everybody, it was interesting, everybody kind of knew, you know, and they're organized. The way the country is organized is quite wonderful. They're organized along horizontal lines and vertical lines. So they have a spirit of in the African villages in Botswana, they have the Khoisies, which are the chiefs. And if there is ever a problem in the village, everything comes to the chief and everybody in the village gets to talk about it. You know, if a woman is going to get married, everybody talks about it. And the Botswana, people from Botswana really talk. So we went through a number of presentations in that regard. But they just really showed up and were marvelous.
How did the local casting calls work initially?
The casting was always something that was difficult for them to understand, and I think, I mean, casting is difficult for me to understand. It's not.
So they weren't coming in with stacks of headshots. This was not how it worked.
Well, we had a local guy who decided to set up a website that you know, and charge people, which wasn't us. So we had some of those issues that we had to sort out. I think the one thing that always was a disappointment for Botswana initially, and of course this has changed once they've seen her performance, but they were very nationalistic about Ma Ramotswe.
And she's played by Jill Scott, who's an American actress.
Yes, from Philadelphia. And it's hysterical when she's on set and she's doing her lines and she has the Setswana accent. And then suddenly, you know, she's this, God, I can't do this. And she has a very South Philly accent. So she did a really marvelous job portraying a traditionally built African woman. She spent hours and hours and days with a dialect coach to prepare. The people of Botswana didn't completely understand why somebody from their country couldn't play the role. And I would say to them, well, Meryl Streep got, you know, the Academy Award for Sophie's Choice for playing a Polish woman, and she wasn't Polish. Or Kate Winslet, you know, played an American woman, and she was. So really, it's casting is blind to nationalities. But of course, they have fallen in love with Jill, and
she really is luminous.
She is. This is amazing. I mean, she is a woman that I consider a close friend and a confidant, and just, you know, just she, and she is, for that Philly accent and for that strength of character, she is Ma Ramotswe.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear just a little bit more of her performance.
Coco. Coco.
Dumela, ma.
Dumelam, I need some stamps.
I'm sorry, we are a detective agency now.
So you don't have stamps?
No.
Can I have a postal order for 300 pula?
We don't have that either. We are now a detective agency.
What about envelopes?
I can give you one. No charge.
Thank you.
That's the scene where she's waiting for her first customer to come in,
yes.
and a woman walks in and has been expecting what used to be there, which was a post office.
It doesn't really start off so well for Ma Ramotswe. She doesn't get the customers right away. And, of course, nobody in Botswana knows what a private detective is, and nobody, you know, believes that a woman should be a private detective. And it's so she waits and she waits and she waits, and this woman comes in and, of course, wants stamps.
Amy J. Moore is my guest. She's a producer on the number one ladies detective agency. It will premiere on HBO on March 29th to be followed by a series. There is a screening tonight at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas, sponsored by the Writers Garret and the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. That is already sold out, but again, you can catch it on HBO March 29th. We'll return to our discussion in just a moment, and you're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Producer Amy J. Moore is with us. She has just completed The Number One Ladies Detective Agency. It will premiere as a movie on HBO March 29th, followed by a series. You're welcome to join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Is there an infrastructure now, and you mentioned that they've started in Botswana their own sort of film commission. Is there an infrastructure now with trained people who could work on the next big project that comes in?
Well, like I said, from the first year to the second year, because we shot the first episode, which is the pilot that Anthony did in 2007, and then we did the six following episodes in 2008. And from year to year, people got better, and we were able to promote people up through positions. And it was really us getting a skill base going and sort of making sure that skills transference was going on. But we by our heads of department, we had two heads of department that were actually local people, and including casting, which I think was a good choice. So yes, I mean, the equipment is still not there necessarily, but it's easy to get. And I think that there are people that I would feel very comfortable if a producer wanted to go and shoot in Botswana. I could give names and phone numbers of people that I think would understand the magnitude of what we shot.
Was that a goal for you to also sort of leave behind this group of individuals who had the skills to take on different kinds of work?
It was absolutely the thing for me, because the thing that is so rewarding about this movie and this project in general, it not only shows a very positive view of Africa and a view that we don't normally get in our Western culture. I mean, there are real things that we can learn from Africa, but it also leaves behind a platform for economic development and for self-sufficiency. And that, to me, is really what I'm about when I produce something.
Can you talk a little bit about what Botswana is like today? It has fared better than a lot of its neighbors in the southern part of Africa, but it's a small country with a not very dense population.
It's a magnificent country. I mean, it's a country that people fall in love with immediately. It's a country that is very generous of spirit. People greet each other. I think on the last clip that we heard, you heard the woman who wanted stamps say koko, which is the way you enter a house. It's almost like knock knock, mm-hmm. but nobody here would ever say knock knock. Jill Scott then said demela ma, and ma is the term for female, ra is the term for male. So, you know, she said demela, and you have to go through that entire sequence
mm-hmm.
and then you have to say Lakai, how are you, did you sleep well, I slept well, if you slept well, you know, and it sort of goes on and on and on, but there's a graciousness and a pace that it results from that, from knowing your neighbors, that is great.
One thing that I really love about the film, and in fact I liked her character even better I think on film than I did when I read the book, is the relationship that Ma Ramotswe has with her secretary, who is in some ways fully steeped in the culture, and in other ways doesn't quite fit in with that relaxed pace of life that we see from so many other people.
Well, Mama Kutsi, who plays the secretary, I mean, who is the secretary, the character, and Anika Noni Rose, who plays the role, really is a fish out of water in her own culture. She's very ambitious. She's very uptight. She's many things that Botswana aren't. And, of course, she got, and she doesn't fail to let everybody know. 97%, the highest mark ever at the Botswana Secretarial College.
I know him. He acts strange. When he acts strange, I get a feeling.
A feeling?
Last Wednesday, for instance, he told me he was delayed in Maun, and then he didn't come home at all.
Very bad sign.
Last night, he took me for a romantic buffet dinner at Habaroni-san and told me I was the most beautiful woman in Botswana.
Adulterer!
Thank you, Ma.
I'm sorry. My secretary is new.
And that was who we heard there. And we have a clip coming up where we hear her being hired for the first time, mm-hmm. actually. But everyone seems to be very passionate and really speak what's on their mind, which is interesting. And I'm wondering how much that's part of the everyday culture as well.
Well, it's interesting because it's a very polite culture. And they're things that you would never do in terms of directness and in terms of that in Africa in general, because there is a culture that prevails across the countries, the 54 countries. But the women are strong. And I think that what you're picking up is that strength of female characters. The women really keep the place together. And nothing, you get the sense, while they may not push themselves forward, you know, they're now cozies in the village, the chiefs in the village that are female. But the women play an incredible role.
And one thing that's also really interesting about the lead character is her ability to sort of sit back and watch things. And just there are entire scenes where she's just sort of thinking about things mm-hmm. and trying to plan out what she's going to mm-hmm. do next. Mm-hmm. And there's this idea that observation is as important mm-hmm. as action.
Mm. Well, that's really something that right in the beginning of the movie, Anthony brilliantly portrays with her father. Her father teaches, you know, it starts with the little girl and the father teaches her by blindfolding her to remember things that are part of their culture, the Botswana flag, the, you know, so it's a memory. It's a, and Ma Ramatoi, I think, is happiest over a cup of bush tea.
Is it a very nationalistic place? Because even the word Botswana comes up so many times in so many scenes. Is that on the tongues of people as they go about their daily lives?
Ma Ramatoi loves Botswana. Mm-hmm. And I think that if somebody does ever check out page 225, but that's actually in the African edition, that's what you get the sense of is that she just is absolutely in love with her country. And the people are nationalistic, but in the best way. There's not much, you know, Botswana is a success story of Africa. There's not much to complain about in Botswana. People, I mean, we can always complain. You know, I am a New Yorker, but it's just they have the diamonds. They have used the monies they've gotten from the diamonds well. They were never a colony. And I think that has a real significance because they never felt that colonialism. They were a protectorate, an English protectorate under, and they were being protected, ironically, from South Africa and the borders, as the borders started expanding from South Africa. But then independence came to the country in 1966 with Sir Seretse Khama, who was the first president of Botswana, who was a tribal chief. And Botswana was very blessed to have Sir Seretse Khama marry Ruth Khama, who was an Englishwoman, and it was a huge outcry worldwide. The Church of England wouldn't marry them. It was because they were racially mixed. But because of that, if you look at the Botswana flag, you have three colors. You've got the black and the white, which represent black people and white people. So you have this sense of racial-free relationships. And you have the blue, of course, which represents the sky or water. I've heard both.
You mentioned earlier the African edition of the book, and I'm wondering how well it went over when it was first published there and whether people felt like this Scotsman is writing about us and it fully describes us, or did they think he's, you know, looking at it from a foreigner's perspective?
I think at first, because I made several trips to Botswana before Anthony started really working on it, and I think the people were a bit puzzled. I remember one woman saying to me, "But I don't understand that's my neighbor. Why am I reading about my neighbor?" You know, so it was this sense of you know, they didn't understand what we were celebrating about their culture. They were just living the culture.
What's so interesting about that, Amy, is that in some ways it's so, not that there aren't any glimpses of sort of darker things, but it's so simple in some ways, and the life that we observe almost feels like a fable.
Well,
looking
a
at
fable.
It through Western eyes, there's elements of reality, but it also seems like something we all want to gravitate toward.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's funny that you should use that word, because you're the only person besides myself that uses that word fable. We do often get criticized. The books get criticized for being very simple and being, you know, about ordinary things in life. And I have said to people, it's a fable. You don't know really what, you know, Cinderella's prince looks like. We think Cinderella's blonde simply because that's what Disney told us she looked like. So I think in the same way, this is about how to be a good person, how to be a good, you know, how to have morals, how to keep your integrity, how to tell the truth, how to be a good neighbor, you know, and love your country. I mean,
you talk about what Cinderella looked like, and another really appealing thing is the fact that Ma Ramotswe is what is euphemistically called, I guess, traditionally built, meaning she's quite heavy.
She's kind of big.
And people speak very openly about her being fat, and she never takes this as an insult.
Oh, no. I mean, in Africa, I mean, one of the greatest reasons I would encourage everybody that's listening to go to Africa is because you can eat everything. And I think it was our continuity woman on set one day that said, and she's done all of Nora Ephron's films, and she did 5 films with Anthony, and she's really seasoned. And she sat there and she said, you know, this is the first film set I've ever been on where nobody's on a diet. And we loved it. And we all sort of, you know, we kind of, so you gain some weight. You know, it was fine because it's celebrated. That's something that's celebrated in Africa. Big women mean that there is prosperity. And so I think there's a line that Kremlin, we just heard a clip of Alice Boussong, you know, trying to find out whether her husband's cheating on her. And Kremlin is off, you know, Ma Ramotswe is investigating, and Kremlin says, "You are a fat and fabulous woman," you know, and, you know,
and everybody around us.
Amen. You know, fat. So we love fat.
I wonder what it was like being able to sort of observe the transformation of Jill from this South Philly woman to someone who was fully African, and sort of go back and forth. Do you think it changed the way she felt about herself and her heritage, however far back that was?
I think that Jill is really still from South Philly.
Uh-huh.
very
convincing.
She's a phenomenal. I think if anything, she is a phenomenal actress, and I would be very surprised if people didn't recognize what a talent she has, because this is a role that you know, we found very difficult to cast. We tried to cast on 6 different continents. There were many people. I mean, Alexander McCall Smith used to go around on his book tours, and he would find a fat woman, and you know, lo and behold, she'd be emailing me. So, and he would. And at one point, he convinced the Minister of Health, who is a woman that the 8th book is dedicated to, Sheila Clow. He convinced her that she was Ma Ramotswe, and she is this divine woman. But she, you know, she couldn't do what Jill did, but it made Lucien, who plays JLB Maniconi, a little nervous, because every time, you know, he went by the Minister of Health, he, you know, in front of her husband, she would introduce him as her husband.
Is it true that Anthony Minghella first thought about Queen Latifah in the role?
Well, we met with her. We did, and Queen Latifah was just divine. I mean, she's really a great woman. And I remember her saying to Anthony, you know, she hadn't read the books, and she said to Anthony, "She's so charming." And she said, "Does this woman carry a gun?" You know, and it's just so not what the books are. Mm-hmm. And but I think it would have been a different vehicle with, mm-hmm. with Queen Latifah.
Yeah, there's this sort of wide-eyed openness to this character that is unlike any leading woman. You keep thinking for a moment that she's going to sort of turn around, and she doesn't. She stays as trusting of human nature, but as savvy about it at the same time. And it's hard. It's hard until you've seen the film to understand how well that works.
It's hard. I mean, to get that balance right is difficult. And I think that there are, you know, in this day and age, I think it's really lovely to have that gentleness come out. And in fact, the books first, you know, the books weren't published when I found them, but when they were published, they didn't really take off until after 9/11, and when everybody was searching for something that would embrace them. So, but I also think that Jill Scott in her, you know, she has a song that people might know called Hate on Me. And there's a line in that song that says something to the extent of, I'm going to be who I'm going to be. And that South Philly woman is actually the same sentiment that Ma Vermatswe has, that she is who she is.
We'll hear a little bit more from her as we do hear that scene where she is hiring her secretary for the first time.
I was expecting someone
younger,
perhaps younger. When someone says secretary, an image springs to mind of someone who
in a tight skirt who will very soon be disgracing herself under a desk with her boss in ways that only God knows how she can still look at herself in a mirror.
Not quite. Not always.
But often. I cannot tell you the number of times I have applied for jobs with my 97% and found myself in competition with a girl with 42% and a very short skirt. And every time it is short skirt who gets the job.
I'm sorry to hear that.
It is the way of the world.
It is the way of the men's world. But this is the number one ladies' detective agency.
Did those two actors have instant chemistry?
I think... No.
Really?
No. I mean, I think it's a funny thing. We're all such children, really. But they, you know, we are such a family. And I tried to think about why that was at one point, because we, you know, these are people that, you know, I'd walk through glass for, and I mean, and they get along, but they fight like sisters, and there's just a real spirit. I think because we went to this place that was so wonderful, and because there was a sense that we were going to continue, that you know, we all knew we'd see each other the next year, and we'd all have, you know, we might have a baby next year, or we might have a, you know, a new husband or something.
So you have to make it work.
We just got along differently than most film sets get along.
Amy J. Moore is here. She's producer of the number one ladies detective agency. It will premiere on HBO on March 29th, followed by a series after that. You're welcome to join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is producer Amy J. Moore of the number one ladies detective agency. The screening of the premiere film will take place tonight at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas, sponsored by the Writers Garrett and the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. I'm sorry to tell you that event is sold out, but if you have HBO or have a relative who has HBO, you can see the premiere on March 29th, and then the series will follow. I want to talk a little bit about the series. How many of the major players that we see in the premiere will continue through?
Well, most of them. We actually, you know, we've sort of created this village. I mean, certainly the principals. Certainly you have Jill Scott, who plays Mama Ramatswe, and Anika, who plays Mama Kutsi, and Lucien, that plays JLB Matacone. And you have a new character from the books, BK, who is portrayed by Desmond Dubé. So all of them, they're really our staples, and all of them will be back. And of course, the apprentices and the people that reoccur in the books. But there are some people that we really fell in love with, that, you know, like the naughty boy husband. People just love him.
And he's very appealing, even though, you know, he's just doing these awful things.
You just want to go home with him. Uh-huh. I mean, he's really terrific, and he's so charming, and he's just so passionate about his seduction, you know, and he sort of has a wry sense about himself, which I think is why we like him.
I like the scene in the film where you meet him, and he, without giving too much away, he sort of embraces Ma Ramotswe. Mm-hmm. And you get the sense that she's enjoying it just a little bit.
Too much, maybe.
Yeah, but it's very appealing, because as opposed to her, you're wondering for a moment if she's going to actually just throw the whole thing out the window and stick with him for a while.
Right. I don't know about that. I think she's a little too ethical for that, although she does cross a boundary. And I think the one of the things that Anthony saw in Jill Scott and in opening up the character of Ma Ramotswe is her sense of music and her musical ability. Jill is a great singer, as we know, and a great songwriter. And so he recognized that Ma Ramotswe's first husband was Note Makuti, who was a trumpet player, and that passion that crossed the two of them through music was something that Ma Ramotswe has never really lost. So she does miss her first husband, that was unfortunately an abusive relationship. And when she sees Kremlin, she puts Note's music on, and she kind of gets transported back to that time.
Obviously, you have what amounts to an international cast, and you mentioned a dialect coach. How hard was it to make sure that everyone sounded as if they came from the same very small place?
Well, you know, our dialect coach was on set at every minute, and the poor woman was probably the one that worked the hardest of anybody, because she would go over lines with people in the beginning of the day. Our days, we worked 12-hour days, 6-day weeks, and then you know, certain people had to go home and do things like transfer sound, or do, you know, the day did not stop really. So she would Komotso, who actually plays the woman that buys the stamps.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Komotso would get there, would work with the actors before they got on set, and would sit with the script if anybody needed a line reading all through the shooting. And then she would go at night and she would work with new people coming in. So it was really a dedicated effort. Now, with that said, I sat in screenings of the movie in Botswana. And when Jill starts singing, everybody in the theater started laughing. And I was like, oh no, you know,
what have we done?
We've done it really wrong, you know. And I pushed. I was actually with the Minister of Health, and I pushed her, and I said, why? And they said, no, they're laughing because they didn't expect her to get it right.
Huh.
So it was really out of that mouth. They didn't expect the traditional songs to be like they were.
And Komotso, you said her name was?
Komotso.
This is the first time she's done any work like this. Is that right?
She's kind of, well, there's a continuity issue between the first episode and the next that I won't point out. But Komotso takes a reoccurring part in the episode. So she's both the stamp lady, and then she takes a reoccurring part. She's brilliant.
But I mean, she's never been a dialect coach before she worked with you, is that
no,
right?
She's never done that, and she's never acted. But she does both, and she does both brilliantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were people that you cast locally, were they ready for their close-up, or how did it work to sort of get them accustomed to taking direction in the way that was necessary to run a film set?
Anthony was just divine at working with people. And he is the master manipulator of all time. And he's the master charmer. And he, you know, there's a scene in the opening with the little precious Ramotswe, the little girl, where I probably am giving everything away, but there's a mirror cat that, of course, gets on her head. And the little girl just freaked out. And she was just screaming, you know, like every time I see, it's one of those very sweet, almost too sweet moments in this movie. And every time I see it, I laugh because this little kid was so afraid and she was just screaming her guts out. And he just calmed her down but you'd see that when he directed. I remember sitting in rehearsals with him for Madame Butterfly at the Met, and you could just see him put on the kimono and sort of parade down the stage to show how he wanted movement done. And he had a spirit, a child childlike spirit that was infectious. And I think that made people comfortable.
What was the impact on the cast and the crew to lose Anthony Minghella and just a couple of months later to lose Sidney Pollack, who was a producer on the film?
Well, Anthony Minghella and Sidney Pollack were my two original partners on this. And both of them were just magnificent men. I think, you know, we always had a... You know, a lot of people came back to do it because we wanted to preserve the spirit of both of them. And I think that – I think we have done that. But I also think, you know, we had – you know, there were moments of silence and, you know, we went through a lot of – in Africa, one of the big things that we learned was to honor our ancestors. And in very – Anthony and Sidney are both very much – I consider very much my ancestors. And – there's a sense of ritual that's attached to that that we don't, that many of us in the Western world have lost. And I think going through ritual basically codifies what has meaning. And so there were a lot of things that we did that we didn't even, you know, I mean, that description of the ritual and all of that is what we did, but we never thought of it in those terms. We just did it, and it helped us mourn and heal.
Well, there's a poignancy knowing that backstory to realize that, you know, he directed a scene not too long before he ultimately died of this really beautiful, moving funeral.
Yeah, it's, you know, the funeral, it was, it, he, I mean, we had, he had a driver in Botswana called Good, and Good had AIDS, and Good did something that was bad, actually, and he stopped taking his medicine, and he died over a weekend. Hmm. So we actually had a real live funeral that became, you know, the basis for the funeral that's on screen.
Were there things that you had to do without shooting there that you would never consider going without if you were anywhere else in the Western world?
Restaurants. We've already mentioned the dearth of restaurants. You know, it's for Africans. One of the things that I think really strike people when they visit the continent is the sense of spirit under, you know, the spirit of the people, even though their resources aren't great and even though they don't have a lot of material things. So a lot of time, and that was sometimes a clash between, I mean, a film set is just antithetical to a African culture. I mean, it was just, we were constantly, But everybody was very good spirited about it. But, you know, there were times where you would ask for a table and they'd bring you three chairs because they didn't have a table and couldn't understand why you really wanted a table, and because they're used to dealing with three chairs. So it was, you know, the sense of humor, the African sense of humor is infectious and really fun. But they also make do with what they have. And so in the same way, we made do with what we had.
It's really striking in the film. There's one particular scene where Ma Ramotswe is home and she has her guest coming over, or if you want to call him a guest, a client. And he looks around and says, wow, what sort of woman are you to have a house like this? And it's a very modest house by any kind of Western standards. It's clean and tidy and has everything she needs, but it's nothing that we would consider remarkable.
Well, that house is remarkable.
Well, I know. It drives home how spoiled we are with what we
have. We are very spoiled. We are very spoiled. And when I first moved back, I came back to the States for between the time I ran the film company in South Africa and I did a show in New York in the theater. And when I came back, I was just astounded by all of the trinkets and the gadgets and the seven iPhones and people would have and the television. I'd watch television with my mouth open going, oh my gosh, how does everybody get a car if they go on that show? And, you know, so I think in Africa you rely more on the earth, you rely more on your neighbor, you rely more on bush tea, the things about bush tea. But it's a very astute point that you make about that house, because that is a rich house. That's considered a very luxurious house there.
I wonder, given, Amy, that the books really took off after 9/11, where people were looking for fables and looking for more simplicity and things that weren't so terrifying, if you think the same sort of effect effect will come to the film and to the series when, you know, the economy is so bad, and maybe people are looking for something that, that seems like problems can be solved in a relatively simple way.
Well, I think that's what I said a moment ago about what we can learn from Africa. And I think that we are often very arrogant in our attitudes, and we don't have that skill of observation that you pointed out that Mara Matsue has, where we look at things and we digest things and we jump to conclusions that everything has to be fast and everything has to be speedy. And I think that people have said that these books are almost like therapy, that you sit down and it's better than going to therapy because you just feel like the world makes sense again. And I don't think that there's anything that is totally mysterious about how to lead your life like Mara Matsue. I think we all can do it, and I think we can do it with a bit of a change of attitude.
I love that HBO is the American distributor for this film and for the series, because this is quite a departure based on the things that they've had great success with over the past decade or so. There's not that famous four-syllable swear word that seems to be on every show. It's nowhere to be seen. In fact, there was really nothing that I thought my kids couldn't watch.
I think it's hysterical. We were in the Wall Street Journal last Friday, and the headline was "No Sex, Different City." I thought that was just summed it up. But the other point about HBO has just been brilliant. I mean, I'm going to beg them to hire me because they're just so wonderful. The people there are great. But they also considered this material very controversial and challenging, whereas they don't consider Sopranos, or they don't consider, because everybody, that's what everybody's used to.
The formula they know that works.
Those words that, you know, the four-letter words and everything, they find this to be what is going to be challenging. And so I think that's marvelous.
Is it different working with the BBC? And are there standards, sort of, obviously they're different from HBO, but I'm wondering how that works when you've got two very different organizations that are going to be putting this project out?
I think, you know, I really sound too Pollyanna here, honestly, but I think because it's a little like every time Alexander McCall Smith found somebody that was fat enough and, you know, African enough to be Mara Matsue, he would give them my telephone number.
You stop taking his call after a while?
You know, but I think that, but I always wrote back to them, and I think that because of the nature of this material, everybody got along really well. We had very little conflict.
Will there be another season, or is this a complete package?
No, we hope to start doing some more. Mm-hmm. I mean, it will depend. I mean, it always depends on what audiences like and what they'll go for, and whether whether everyone's ready to invite Mara Matsue into their living rooms.
And will they all be based? Is the plan for them all to come from Alexander McCall Smith's books, or will there be a time when some of the stories are original?
Well, he's just finished his 10th book.
So you've got some more material.
Is Tea Time for the Traditionally Built, and that I don't believe is published yet. But he is on board for 13 books, or 11 or 13 books. So he. But the fact is, we're going to have to start inventing some more stories.
Amy, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been great.
Amy J. Moore is a producer on the number one ladies detective agency. You can see it as a premiere movie on HBO March 29th with a series to follow. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.